which meant she bobbed quite often in the beginning. She had been told of Moiraine's faintness, and she asked every 20 paces whether Moiraine wished to sit and catch her breath, or have cool damp cloths brought to her rooms, or hot bricks for her feet, or smelling salts, or a dozen more sure cures for a light head, until Moiraine curtly told her to be quiet. The fool girl led on in silence, face blank. Moiraine cared not a whit whether the woman was offended. All she wanted right then was to find Swan with good news. With the boy in her arms, born on Dragonmount, and his mother packed to travel would be best of all. Most of all, though, she wanted herself out of the halls before she ran into Landman Dragoran. Worrying about him, she rounded a corner behind the serving girl and came face to face with Marian, blue-fringed shawl looped over her arms. The Shatayan herself was guiding Marian, and behind the motherly-looking sister came a train of servants, one woman carrying her red riding gloves, another her fur-trimmed cloak, a third her dark velvet hat. Pairs of men bore wicker pack hampers that could have been carried by one, and others had arms full of flowers. An Aes Sedai received more honor than a mere lady, however high her house. Marian's eyes narrowed at the sight of Moiraine. "A surprise to see you here," she said slowly. "By your dress, I take it you've given over your disguise? But no, still no ring, I see." Moiraine was so startled at the woman's sudden appearance that she hardly heard what Marian said. "Are you alone?" she blurted. For a moment, Marian's eyes became slits. "Larella decided to go her own way. South, I believe. More, I don't know." "It was Catswain I was thinking of," Moiraine said, blinking in surprise. The more she had thought about Catswain, the more she had become convinced the woman must be Black Aja. What surprised her was Larella. Larella had seemed bent on reaching Chutchin and without delay. Of course, plans could change. But suddenly Moiraine realized something that should have been obvious. Black sisters could lie. It was impossible. The oaths could not be broken. Yet it had to be. Marian moved close to Moiraine, and when Moiraine took a step back, she followed. Moiraine held herself erect, but she still came no higher than the other woman's chin. "Are you so eager to see Catswain?" Marian said, looking down at her. Her voice was pleasant, her smooth face comforting, but her eyes were cold iron. "The last I saw her, she said that next time she met you, she'd spank your bottom till you couldn't sit for a week. She'll do it, too." Abruptly glancing at the servants, she seemed to realize they were not alone. The iron faded, but it did not disappear. "Catswain was right, you know. A young woman who thinks she knows more than she does can land herself in very deep trouble. I suggest you be very still and very quiet until we can talk." Her gesture for the Shatayan to lead on was peremptory, and the dignified woman leaped to obey. A king or queen might find themselves in a Shatayan's bad graces, but never an Aes Sedai. Moiraine stared after Marian until she vanished around a corner far down the corridor. Everything Marian had just said could have come from one of Tamra's chosen. Black sisters could lie. Had Larella changed her mind about Chutchin? Or was she dead somewhere, like Tamra and the others? Suddenly she realized she was smoothing her skirts. Stilling her hands was easy, but she could not stop herself trembling faintly. Ellis was staring at her with her mouth open. "You're Aes Sedai, too," the woman squeaked, then gave a jump, taking Moiraine's wince for a grimace. "You must be in disguise," she said breathlessly. "I won't say a word to anyone, Aes Sedai. I swear by the light and my father's grave." As if every person behind Marian had not heard everything she had. They would not hold their tongues. "Take me to Landman Dragoran's apartments," Moiraine told her. What was true at sunrise could change by noon, and so could what was necessary. She took the great serpent ring from her pouch and put it on her right hand. Sometimes you had to gamble. After a long walk, mercifully in silence, Ellis rapped at a red door and announced to the gray-haired woman who opened it that the Lady Moiraine Damodred Aes Sedai wished to speak with King Al-Lan Mandragoran. The woman had added her own touches to what Moiraine told her. King, indeed. Shockingly, the reply came back that Lord Mandragoran had no wish to speak with any Aes Sedai. The gray-haired woman looked scandalized, but closed the door firmly. Ellis stared at Moiraine, wide-eyed.
"I can show my Lady Aes Sedai to her own rooms now," she said uncertainly. "If—"
She squeaked when Moiraine pushed open the door and went in. The gray-haired serving woman and a younger leaped up from where they had been sitting, apparently darning shirts. A bony young man scrambled awkwardly to his feet beside the fireplace, looking to the women for instruction. They simply stared at Moiraine until she raised a questioning eyebrow. Then the gray-haired woman pointed to one of the two doors leading deeper into the apartments. The door she pointed to led to a sitting room much like Moiraine's own, but all of the gilded chairs had been moved back against the walls and the flowered carpets rolled up. Shirtless, Lan was practicing the sword in the cleared area. A small golden locket swung at his neck as he moved, his blade a blur. Sweat covered him, and the wounds she had healed him of had been replaced by claw marks from some wild animal on his back? Or marks left by a woman? Could this cold man actually inspire such passion in a woman that she would— She felt her cheeks heating at the image that popped into her head. Let him have as many women as he wished, so long as he did what she wished. He spun gracefully out of the forms to face her, the point of his sword grounding on the floor tiles. He still did not quite meet her gaze, in that strange way he and Bukama had. His hair hung damply, clinging to his face despite the leather cord, but he was not breathing hard.
"You," he growled. "So you are Aes Sedai and a Damodred today. I've no time for your games, Kyrianen. I'm waiting for someone."
Cold blue eyes flickered to the door behind her. Oddly, what appeared to be a cord woven of hair was tied around the inner handle in an elaborate knot.
"She will not be pleased to find another woman here."
"Your lady love need have no fear of me," Moiraine told him dryly. "For one thing, you are much too tall, and for another, I prefer men with at least a modicum of charm and manners. I came for your help. There was a pledge made and held since the War of the Hundred Years that Malkyr would ride when the White Tower called. I am Aes Sedai, and I call you."
"You know the hills are high, but not how they lie," he muttered, as if quoting some Malkyrie saying.
Stalking across the room away from her, he snatched up his scabbard and sheathed the sword forcefully.
"I'll give you your help, if you can answer a question. I've asked Aes Sedai over the years, but they wriggled away from answering like vipers. If you are Aes Sedai, answer it."
"If I know the answer, I will." She would not tell him again that she was what she was, but she embraced Sidar and moved one of the gilded chairs out into the middle of the floor. She could not have lifted the thing with her hands, yet it floated easily on flows of air, and would have had it been twice as heavy. Sitting, she rested her hands on crossed knees where the golden serpent on her finger was plain. The taller person had an advantage when both stood, but someone standing must feel they were being judged by someone sitting, especially an Aes Sedai. He did not seem to feel anything of the kind. For the first time since she had met him, he met her eyes directly, and his stare was blue ice.
"When Malkyr died," he said in tones of quiet steel, "Shinar and Arafel sent men. They could not stop the flood of Trollocs and Murdral, yet they came. Men rode from Kandor and even Saldea. They came too late, but they came."
Blue ice became blue fire. His voice did not change, but his knuckles grew white, gripping his sword.
"For 900 years we rode when the White Tower called. But where was the tower when Malkyr died? If you or Aes Sedai, answer me that." Moiraine hesitated. The answer he wanted was sealed to the tower, taught to accept it in history lessons, yet forbidden to any except initiates of the tower. But what was another penance alongside what she faced? Over 100 sisters were ordered to Malkier, she said more calmly than she felt. By everything she had been taught, she should ask a penance for what she had told him already. Even Aes Sedai cannot fly, however. They were too late. By the time the first had arrived, the armies of Malkier were already broken by endless hordes of shadow spawn, the people fleeing or dead. The death of Malkier had been hard and blood-soaked and fast. That was before I was born, but I regret it deeply, and I regret that the tower decided to keep their efforts secret. Better that the tower be thought to have done nothing than to have it known Aes Sedai had tried and failed. Failure was a blow to stature, and mystery and armor the tower needed. Aes Sedai had reasons of their own for what they did and for what they did not do, and those reasons were known only to Aes Sedai. That is as much answer as I can give. More than I should have. More than any other sister ever will, I think. Will it suffice? For a time he simply looked at her, fire slowly fading to ice once more. His eyes fell away.
Almost I can believe, he muttered finally, without saying what he almost believed. He gave a bitter laugh. What help can I give you?
Moiraine frowned. She very much wanted time alone with this man to bring him to heel, but that had to wait. She very much hoped he was not a dark friend. There is another sister in the palace, Marian Redhill. I need to know where she goes, what she does, who she meets. He blinked, but did not ask the obvious questions. Perhaps he knew he would get no answers, but his silence was still pleasing.
I've been keeping to my rooms the past few days, he said, looking at the door again. I do not know how much watching I can do.
In spite of herself, she sniffed. The man promised help, then looked anxiously for his lady. Perhaps he was not what she had thought. But he was who she had. Not you, she told him. Her visit here would be known throughout the Aes Daishar soon, if it was not already, and if he was noticed spying on Marian, that could be disaster even if the woman was as innocent as a babe. I thought you might ask one of the Malkieri I understand have gathered here to follow you. Someone with a sharp eye and a close tongue. This must be done in utter secrecy.
No one follows me, he said sharply.
Glancing at the door once more, he suddenly seemed weary. He did not slump, but he moved to the fireplace and propped his sword beside it with the care of a tired man. Standing with his back to her, he said,
I will ask Bukama and Rhine to watch her, but I cannot promise for them. That is all I can do for you.
She stifled a vexed sound. Whether it was all he could do or all he would, she had no leverage to force him. Bukama, she said, only him. Going by how he had behaved around her, Rhine would be too busy gaping at Marian to see or hear anything. That was if he did not confess what he was doing the moment Marian looked at him. And do not tell him why. His head whipped around, but after a moment he nodded. And again he did not ask the questions most people would have. Telling him how to get word to her by notes passed to her maid Suki, she prayed she was not making a grave mistake. Back in her own rooms, she discovered just how quickly news had spread. In the sitting room, Swan was offering a tray of sweetmeats to a tall, full-mouthed young woman in pale green silk, little older than a girl, with black hair that fell well below her hips, and a small blue dot painted on her forehead, about where the stone of Moiraine's Kessiera hung. Swan's face was smooth, but her voice was tight as she made introductions. The Lady Isella quickly showed why.
"Everyone in the palace is saying you are Aes Sedai," she said, eyeing Moiraine doubtfully. She did not rise, much less curtsy, or even incline her head. "If that is so, I need your assistance. I wish to go to the White Tower. My mother wants me to marry. I would not mind Lan as my Carneira if Mother were not already his, but when I marry, I think it will be one of my warders. I will be Green Aja.
She frowned faintly at Swan.
Don't hover, girl. Stand over there until you are needed.
Swan took up a stance by the fireplace, back stiff and arms folded beneath her breasts. No real servant would have stood so, or frowned so, but Isella no longer noticed her.
Do sit down, Moiraine, she went on with a smile, and I will tell you what I need of you. If you are Aes Sedai, of course.
Moiraine stared, invited to take a chair in her own sitting room. This silly child was certainly a suitable match for Lan when it came to arrogance. Her Carneira? That meant first in the old tongue and plainly something else here. Not what it seemed to, of course. Even these Malchieri could not be that peculiar. Sitting, she said dryly, "Choosing your Aja should at least wait until I test you to see whether there is any point in sending you to the tower. A few minutes will determine whether you can learn to channel and your potential strength if you—" The girl blithely broke in.
"Oh, I was tested years ago. The Aes Sedai said I would be very strong. I told her I was 15, but she learned the truth. I don't see why I could not go to the tower at 12 if I wanted. Mother was furious. She has always said I was to be queen of Malkir one day, but that means marrying Lan, which I would not want even if Mother weren't his Carneira. When you tell her you are taking me to the tower, she will have to listen. Everyone knows that Aes Sedai take any woman they want for training, and no one can stop them."
That full mouth pursed.
"You are Aes Sedai, aren't you?"
Moiraine performed the rosebud exercise. "If you want to go to Tar Valon, then go. I certainly do not have time to escort you. You will find sisters there about whom you can have no doubts. Suki, will you show the Lady Isella out? No doubt she does not wish to delay in setting off before her mother catches her." The chit was all indignation, of course, but Moiraine wanted only to see the back of her, and Swan very nearly pushed her out into the corridor, protesting every step of the way. Moiraine felt Swan embrace the source, and the protests cut off with a sharp yelp. "That one," Swan said as she came back, dusting her hands, "won't last a month if she can equal Cadswain." "Ciaran herself can toss her from the top of the tower for all I care," Moiraine snapped. "Did you learn anything?" "Well, I learned that young Cal knows how to kiss, and aside from that I came up with a bucket of bilge water."
Swan scowled suddenly.
"Why are you looking at me that way? I only kissed him, Moiraine. Have you kissed a pretty man since young Cormanus the night before you left for the tower? Well, it's been as long for me, too. And Cal is very pretty."
"That is all very well," Moiraine said briskly. Light. How long since she had thought of Cormanus. He had been beautiful.
Surprisingly, learning that Moiraine had approached Lan upset Swan more than Marian's appearance.
"Skin me and salt me if you don't take idiot risks, Moiraine. A man who claims the throne of a dead country is 9 kinds of fool. He could be flapping his tongue about you right this minute to anybody who'll bloody listen. If Marian learns you're having her watched, burn me."
"He is many kinds of fool, Swan, but I do not think he ever flaps his tongue. Besides, you cannot win if you will not risk a copper, as you always tell me your father used to say. We have no choice but to take risks. With Marian here, time may be running out. You must reach the Lady Ines as quickly as you can."
"I'll do what I can," Swan muttered, and stalked out, squaring her shoulders as if for a struggle. But she was smoothing her skirt over her hips, too. Moiraine hoped matters were not going to proceed beyond kissing. Swan's business if it did, but that sort of thing was foolish, especially with a footman. Night had long since fallen, and she was trying to read by lamplight when Swan returned. Moiraine set her book aside. She'd been staring at the same page for the past hour. This time Swan did have news, delivered while digging through her woolen dresses and shifts. For one thing, she had been approached on her way back to Moiraine's rooms by a grisly old stork, who asked if she was Suki, then told her Marian had spent almost the entire day with Prince Briss before retiring to her apartments for the night. No clue there to anything. More importantly, Swan had been able to bring up Raheen in casual conversation with Cal. The footman had not been with the Lady Ines when the boy was born, but he did know the day. One day after the Aiel began their retreat from Tar Valon. Moiraine and Swan shared a long look over that. One day after Gitara Moroso had made her foretelling of the dragon's rebirth and dropped dead from the shock of it. Dawn over the mountain, and born during the 10 days before that sudden thaw. Anyway, Swan went on, beginning to make a bundle of clothes and stockings. I led Cal to believe I'd been dismissed from your service for spilling wine on your dress, and he's offered me a bed with the Lady Ines's servants. He thinks he might be able to get me a place with his lady. She snorted with amusement, then caught Moiraine's eyes and snorted again, more roughly. It isn't his bloody bed, Moiraine. And if it was, well, he has a gentle manner and the prettiest brown eyes you've ever seen. One of these days you're going to find yourself ready to do more than dream about some man, and I hope I'm there to see it. Do not talk nonsense, Moiraine told her. The task in front of them was too important to spare thoughts for men, in the way Swan meant, at least. Marian had spent all day with Briss, without going near Lady Ines. One of Tamra's chosen or Black Aja, that made no sense, and it went beyond credibility to believe Marian was not one or the other. She was missing something, and that worried her. What she did not know could kill her. Worse, it could kill the dragon reborn in his cradle.
Chapter 26. The Last Chapter. When to Surrender. Lan slipped through the corridors of the Eastashar alone, using every bit of the skill he had learned in the Blight, taking care not to round a corner until he was certain the hallway ahead was empty. Wrapped in the Kodi, he could almost feel it whenever someone entered the corridor behind him, feel the beginning of another presence, and duck out of sight through an open door or an archway before whoever it was could see him. He might have been a ghost. Anya and Esni took Idain's commands ahead of his now, as though they believed that some part of Malkyrie ways. She might have told them it was. Bulin remained loyal, he believed so, but he expected that anyone in the Eastashar wearing livery would tell Idain where to find him. He thought he knew where he was now. Despite those previous visits, without a guide he had gotten lost twice since leaving his rooms, and only a feel for direction let him find himself again. He felt a fool for wearing his sword. Steel was no use in this battle, but he felt naked without it, and naked was one thing he could not afford to be against a Dane. A flicker of movement made him flatten himself against the wall behind a statue of a woman clad in clouds, her arms full of flowers. Just in time. Two women came out of the crossing corridor ahead, pausing in close conversation. Izella and the Aes Sedai Marian. He was as still as the stone he hid behind. It was motion that attracted eyes. He did not like skulking, but while Idain was untying the knot in his deori that had kept him penned for 2 days, she had made it clear that she intended to announce his marriage to Izella soon. Bukama had been right. Idain used his deori like reins. By custom, most of her power over him would end once Izella had the cord of his hair among her keepsakes. No longer any more than a token of the past. Yet he was certain Idain would use Izella herself in its place. And Izella would cooperate. He doubted that she had the strength to stand against her mother openly. The only thing to do when faced by an opponent you could not defeat was run, unless your death could serve some greater purpose. And he very much wanted to run. Only Bukama held him here. Bukama and a dream. At a sharp gesture from Marian, Izella nodded eagerly and hurried back the way they had come. For a moment, Marian watched her go, face unreadable in Aes Sedai serenity. Then surprisingly, she followed, gliding along the green floor tiles in a way that made Izella look awkward. Lan did not waste time wondering what Marian was up to, any more than he had in wondering why Moiraine wanted her watched. A man could go mad trying to puzzle out Aes Sedai. Which Moiraine really must be, or Marian would have her howling up and down the corridors. Waiting long enough for the pair to move well out of sight again, he slipped quietly to the corner and peeked. They were both gone, so he hurried on. Aes Sedai were no concern of his today. He had to talk to Bukama about dreams. Running would end Idain's schemes of marriage. If he avoided her long enough, she would find another husband for Izella. Running would end Idain's dream of reclaiming Malkir. Her support would fade like mist under a noon sun once people learned he was gone. Running would end many dreams. The man who had carried an infant tied to his back had a right to dreams, though. Duty was a mountain, but it had to be carried. Ahead lay a long flight of broad stone-railed stairs. He turned to start down, and suddenly he was falling. He just had time to go limp, and then he was bouncing from step to step, tumbling head over heels, landing on the tiled floor at the bottom with a crash that drove the last remaining air from his lungs. Spots shimmered in front of his eyes. He struggled to breathe, to push himself up. Servants appeared from nowhere, helping him to his feet, all exclaiming over his luck in not killing himself in such a fall, asking whether he wanted to see one of the Aes Sedai for healing. Frowning dizzily up the stairway, he murmured replies, anything in hope of making them go away. He thought he might be as bruised as he had ever been in his life, but bruises went away, and the last thing he wanted at that moment was a sister. Most men would have fought that fall and been lucky to end with half their bones broken. Something had jerked his ankles up there. Something had hit him between the shoulders. There was only one thing it could have been, however little sense it made. He would have known had anyone been close enough to touch him physically. And Aes Sedai had tried to kill him with the power.
Lord Mandragoran!
A stocky man in the green coat of a palace guard skidded to a halt and nearly fell over trying to bow while still moving.
We've been looking for you everywhere, my lord,
he panted.
It's your man, Bukama. Come quickly, my lord. He may still be alive.
Cursing, Lan ran behind the guard, shouting for the man to go faster, but he was too late. Too late for the man who had carried an infant. Too late for dreams. Guards crowding a narrow passage just off one of the practice yards squeezed back to let Lan through. Bukama lay face down, blood pooled around his mouth, the plain wooden hilt of a dagger rising from the dark stain on the back of his coat. His staring eyes looked surprised. Kneeling, Lan closed those eyes and murmured a prayer for the last embrace of the mother to welcome Bukama home.
Who found him?
He asked, but he barely heard the jumbled replies about who and where and what. He hoped Bukama was reborn in a world where the golden crane flew on the wind, and the seven towers stood unbroken, and the thousand lakes shone like a necklace beneath the sun. How could he have let anyone get close enough to do this? Bukama could feel steel being unsheathed near him. Only one thing was sure. Bukama was dead because Lan had tangled him in an Aes Sedai's schemes. Rising, he began to run again. Not away from anything, though. Toward someone. And he did not care who saw him.
The muffled crash of the door in the anteroom and outraged shouts from the serving women lifted Moiraine from the cushioned armchair where she had been waiting. For anything but this. Embracing Sayadar, she started from the sitting room, but before she reached the door it swung open. Lan shook off the liveried women clinging to his arms, shut the door in their faces, and put his back to it, meeting Moiraine's startled gaze. Purpling bruises marred his angular face, and he moved as if he had been beaten. From outside came silence. Whatever he intended, they would be sure she could handle it. Absurdly, she found herself fingering her belt knife. With the power, she could wrap him up like a child, however large he was, and yet... He did not glare. There certainly was no fire in those eyes. She wanted to step back. No fire, but death seared cold. That black coat suited him with its cruel thorns and stark golden blossoms. Bukama is dead with a knife in his heart, he said calmly. And not an hour gone, someone tried to kill me with the one power. At first I thought it must be Marian, but the last I saw of her, she was trailing after Izella, and unless she saw me and wanted to lull me, she had no time. Few see me when I do not want to be seen, and I don't think she did. That leaves you. Moiraine winced, and only in part for the certainty in his tone. She should have known the fool girl would go straight to Marian. "You would be surprised how little escapes a sister," she told him, "especially if the sister was filled with Sidar. Perhaps I should not have asked Bukama to watch Marian. She is very dangerous." The woman was Black Adra. She was certain of that now. Sisters might make painful examples of people caught snooping, but they did not kill them. But what to do about her? Certainty was not proof, surely not proof that would stand up before the Ammerlin seat. And if Sierran herself was black? Not a worry she could do anything about now. What was the woman doing wasting any time at all with Isella? "If you care for the girl, I suggest you find her as quickly as possible and keep her away from Marian." Lan grunted.
"All Aes Sedai are dangerous. Isella is safe enough for the moment. I saw her on my way here, hurrying somewhere with Briss and Dirik. Why did Bukama die, Aes Sedai? What did I snare him in for you?"
Moiraine flung up a hand for silence, and a tiny part of her was surprised when he obeyed. The rest of her thought furiously. Marian with Isella. Isella with Briss and Dirik. Marian had tried to kill Lan. Suddenly she saw a pattern, perfect in every line. It made no sense, but she did not doubt it was real. "Dirik told me you are the luckiest man in the world," she said, leaning toward Lan intently. "And for his sake, I hope he was right. Where would Briss go for absolute privacy? Somewhere he would not be seen or heard. It would have to be a place he felt comfortable, yet isolated."
"There is a walk on the west side of the palace," Lan said slowly.
Then his voice quickened.
"If there is danger to Briss, I must rouse the guards."
He was already turning, hand on the door handle. "No," she said. She still held the power, and she prepared a weave of air to seize him if necessary. "Prince Briss will not appreciate having his guards burst in if Marian is simply talking to him."
"And if she is not talking?" he demanded.
"Then there is not enough time for rousing the guards if they would come. We have no proof of anything against her, Lan. Suspicions against the word of an Aes Sedai." His head jerked angrily, and he growled something about Aes Sedai that she deliberately did not hear. She would have had to make him smart for it, and there was no time. "Take me to this walk, Lan. Let Aes Sedai deal with Aes Sedai, and let us hurry." If Marian did any talking, Moiraine did not expect her to talk for long. Hurry Lan surely did, long legs flashing as he ran. All she could do was gather her skirts high and run after him, ignoring the stares and murmurs of servants and others in the corridors at her exposure of stockinged legs, thanking the light that the man did not outpace her. She let the power fill her as she ran, till sweetness and joy bordered pain in their intensity, and tried to plan what she would do, what she could do, against a woman considerably stronger than she, a woman who had been Aes Sedai more than 100 years before her own great-grandmother was born. She wished she were not so afraid. She wished Swan were with her. The mad dash led through glittering state chambers, along statuary-lined hallways, and suddenly they were into the open, the sounds of the palace left behind, on a long stone-railed walk, 20 paces wide, with a vista across the city roofs far below. A cold wind blew like a storm, tugging at her skirts. Marian was there, surrounded by the glow of Sidar, and Briss and Dirik standing by the rail, twisting futilely against bonds and gags of air. Isella was frowning at the prince and his son, and surprisingly, further down the walk stood a glowering Rhine, his arms folded across his chest. So he was a dark friend.
"And I could hardly bring Lord Dirik to you without his father," Isella was saying petulantly. "I did make sure no one knows, but why?"
Weaving a shield of spirit, Moiraine hurled it at Marian with every shred of the power in her, hoping against hope to cut the woman off from the source. The shield struck and splintered. Marian was too strong, drawing too near her capacity. She knew she had caught the blue sister, the black sister, by surprise, but Marian did not even blink.
"You did well enough killing the spy, Rhine," she said calmly as she wove a gag of air to stop up Isella's mouth, and bonds that held the girl stiff and wide-eyed. "See if you can make certain of the younger one this time. You did say you are a better swordsman. Everything seemed to happen at once. Rhine rushed forward, scowling, the bells in his braids chiming. Lan barely got his own sword out in time to meet him. And before the first clash of steel on steel, Marian struck at Moiraine with the same weave she herself had used, but stronger. In horror, Moiraine realized that Marian might have sufficient strength remaining to shield her, even while she was embracing as much of Sidar as she could. Frantically, she struck out with air and fire, and Marian grunted as the severed flows snapped back into her. In the brief interval, Moiraine tried to slice the flows holding Derek and the others, but before her weave touched Marian's, Marian sliced hers instead, and this time Marian's attempted shield actually touched her before she could cut it. Moiraine's stomach tried to tie itself in a knot. "You appear too often, Moiraine," Marian said, as though they were simply chatting. She looked as if there were no more to it, serene and motherly, not in the slightest perturbed. "I fear I must ask you how and why." Moiraine just managed to sever a weave of fire that would have burned off her clothes and perhaps most of her skin, and Marian smiled, a mother, amused at the mischief young women get up to. "Don't worry, child. I'll heal you to answer my questions. And answer you will. Out here, no one will hear your screams." If Moiraine had had any lingering doubts that Marian was Black Adra, that weave of fire would have ended them. In the next moments she had more proof. Weavings that made sparks dance on her dress and her hair rise. Weavings that had her gasping for air that was no longer there. Weavings she could not recognize, yet surely would have left her broken and bleeding if they settled around her, if she had failed to cut them. When she could, she tried again and again to cut the bonds holding Derek and the others, to shield Marian, even to knock her unconscious. She knew she fought for her life. She would die if the other woman won, now or after Marian's questioning, but she never considered that loophole in the oaths that held her. She had questions of her own for the woman, and the fate of the world might rest on the answers. Unfortunately, most of what she could do was defend herself, and that always on the brink. Her stomach was in a knot, and trying to make another. Holding three people bound, Marian was still a match for her, and maybe more. If only Lan could distract the woman. A hasty glance showed how unlikely that was. Lan and Rhine danced the forms, gracefully flowing from one to another, their blades like whirlwinds, but if there was a hair between their abilities, it rested with Rhine. Blood fanned down the side of Lan's face. Grimly, Moiraine bore down, not even sparing the bit of concentration necessary to ignore the cold. Shivering, she struck at Marian, defended herself and struck again, defended and struck. If she could manage to wear the woman down, or... "This is taking too long, don't you think, child?" Marian said. Derek floated into the air, struggling against the bonds he could not see as he drifted over the railing. Briss's head twisted following his son, and his mouth worked around his unseen gag. "No!" Moiraine screamed. Desperately, she flung out flows of air to drag the boy back to safety. Marian slashed them even as she released her own hold on him. Wailing, Derek fell, and white light exploded in Moiraine's head. Groggily, she opened her eyes, the boy's fading shriek still echoing in her mind. She was on her back on the stone walk, her head spinning. Until that cleared, she had as much chance of embracing Sidar as a cat did of singing. Not that it made any difference now. She could see the shield Marian was holding on her, and even a weaker woman could maintain a shield once in place. She tried to rise, fell back, managed to push up on an elbow. Only moments had passed. Lan and Rhine still danced their deadly dance to the clash of steel. Briss was rigid for more than his bonds, staring at Marian with such implacable hate it seemed he might break free on the strength of his rage. Isella was trembling, snuffling and weeping and staring wide-eyed at where the boy had fallen. Derek. Moiraine made herself think the boy's name, flinched to recall his grinning enthusiasm. Only moments. "You will hold a little longer for me, I think," Marian said, turning away from her. Briss rose above the walk. The stocky man's face never changed, never stopped staring hatred at Marian.
Moiraine struggled to her knees. She could not channel. She had no courage left, no strength, only determination. Briss floated over the railing. Moiraine tottered to her feet. Determination. That look of pure hate etched on his face, Briss fell, never making a sound. This had to end. Isella lifted into the air, writhing frantically, throat working in an effort to scream past her gag. It had to end, now. Stumbling, Moiraine drove her belt knife into Marian's back to the hilt, blood spurting over her hands. They fell to the paving stones together, the glow around Marian vanishing as she died, the shield on Moiraine vanishing. Isella screamed, swaying where Marian's bonds had let her drop, atop the stone railing. Pushing herself to move, Moiraine scrambled across Marian's corpse, seized one of Isella's flailing hands in hers, just as the girl's slippers slid off into open air. The jolt pulled Moiraine belly down across the railing, staring down at the girl held by her blood-slick grip above a drop that seemed to go on forever. It was all Moiraine could do to hold them where they were, teetering. If she tried to pull the girl up, they would both go over. Isella's face was contorted, her mouth a rictus. Her hand slipped in Moiraine's grasp. Forcing herself to calm, Moiraine reached for the source and failed. Staring down at those distant rooftops did not help her whirling head. Again she tried, but it was like trying to scoop up water with spread fingers. She would save one of the three, though, if the most useless of them. Fighting dizziness, she strove for Sidar, and Isella's hand slid out of her bloody fingers. All Moiraine could do was watch her fall, shrieking a long, dwindling cry, hand still stretched up as if she believed someone might yet save her. An arm pulled Moiraine away from the railing.
"Never watch a death you don't have to," Lan said, setting her on her feet.
His right arm hung at his side, a long slash laying open the blood-soaked sleeve and the flesh beneath, and he had other injuries besides the gash on his scalp that still trickled red down his face. Rhein lay on his back 10 paces away, staring at the sky in sightless surprise.
"A black day," Lan muttered. "As black as ever I've seen."
"A moment," she told him, her voice unsteady. "I am too dizzy to walk far yet."
Her knees wavered as she walked to Marian's body. There would be no answers. The black Aja would remain hidden. Bending, she withdrew her belt knife from the woman's back and cleaned it on the traitor's skirts.
"You are a cool one, Aes Sedai," Lan said flatly.
"As cool as I must be," she told him.
Derek's scream rang in her ears. Isella's face dwindled below her. As in the test for the shawl, all her calm was outward show, but she clung to it tightly. Let go for an instant and she would be on her knees weeping, howling with grief.
"It seems Rhein was wrong, as well as a dark friend. You were better than he."
Lan shook his head slightly.
"He was better, but he thought I was finished with only one arm. He never understood. You surrender after you're dead."
Moiraine nodded.
"Surrender after you are dead,
yes."
It took a little while for her head to clear enough that she could embrace the source again, and she had to put up with Lan's anxiety to let the Shatayan know that Briss and Derek were dead before word came that their bodies had been found on the rooftops. Understandably, he seemed less eager to inform the Lady Idaine of her daughter's death. Moiraine was anxious about time, too, if not for the same reasons. She should have been able to save the girl. That death lay on her as much as on Marian. She healed Lan as soon as she was able, and he gasped in shock as the complex weaves of spirit, air, and water knit up his wounds, flesh writhing together into unscarred wholeness, but she felt no satisfaction that he finally showed himself mortal. He was weak afterward, drained by healing atop his fight, weak enough to catch his breath leaning on the stone rail. He would run nowhere for a while. She had to make sure he knew what to say, and she had other plans for him. Carefully, she floated Marian's body over that rail on flows of air and down a little, close to the stone of the mountain. Flows of fire and flame enveloped the Black Sister. Flame so hot there was no smoke, only a thick shimmering in the air and the occasional crack of a splitting rock.
"What are you?"
Lan began, then changed it to,
"Why?"
She let herself feel the rising heat, currents of air fit for a furnace. There is no proof she was Black Aja, only that she was Aes Sedai. She winced at her slip. The White Tower needed its armor of secrecy again, more than it had when Malkier died, but she could not tell him that, not yet. But he did not so much as blink at mention of the Black Aja. Perhaps he was ignorant of it, but she would not wager on it. The man was as self-contained as any sister. "I cannot lie about what happened here, but I can be silent. Will you be silent, or will you do the shadow's work?"
"You are a very hard woman," he said finally.
That was the only answer he gave, but it was enough. "I am as hard as I must be," she told him. Dirk's scream, Isella's face. There was still Rhine's body to dispose of, and the blood on the floorstones, on their clothing. As hard as she must be. Epilogue. Next dawn found the Aes Daishar in mourning, white banners flying from every prominence, the servants with long white cloths tied to their arms. Rumors in the city already talked of portents that had foretold the deaths, comets in the night, fires in the sky. People had a way of folding what they saw into what they knew and what they wanted to believe. The disappearance of a simple soldier and even of an Aes Sedai escaped notice alongside bone-deep grief that had strong men weeping in the corridors. Returning from destroying Marian's belongings, after searching in vain for any clue to other Black Sisters, Moiraine stepped aside for a Dane Aral, who glided down the hallway in a white gown, her hair cut raggedly short. Whispers said she intended to retire from the world. Moiraine thought she already had. The woman's staring eyes looked haggard and old. In a way, they looked much as her daughter's did, in Moiraine's mind, full of despair and the knowledge of death coming soon. When she entered her apartments, Swan leaped up from a chair in the sitting room. It seemed weeks since Moiraine had seen her.
"You look like you reached into the bait well and found a fangfish," she growled. "Well, it's no surprise. I always hated mourning when I knew the people. Anyway, we can go whenever you're ready. Raheen was born in a farmhouse almost 2 miles from Dragonmount. Marian hasn't been near him, as of this morning. I don't suppose she'll harm him on suspicion, even if she is Black."
Not the one. Somehow Moiraine had almost expected that. "Marian will not harm anyone ever again, Swan. Put that mind of yours to a puzzle for me." Settling in a chair, she began with the end and hurried through, despite Swan's gasps and demands for more detail. It was almost like living it again. Getting to what had led her to that confrontation was a relief. She wanted Dirk dead most of all, Swan. She killed him first. And she tried to kill Lan.
"That's mad," Swan growled. "What links an 8-year-old boy to a cold-hearted lionfish like Lan?"
"Luck. Dirk survived a fall that should have killed him. And everyone says Lan is the luckiest man alive or the Blight would have killed him years ago. It makes a pattern, but the pattern looks crazy to me. Maybe your blacksmith is even part of it. And Joseph Najima back in Canluim, for all I know. He was lucky, too. Puzzle it out for me if you can. I think it is important, but I cannot see how." Swan strode back and forth across the room, kicking her skirt and rubbing her chin, muttering about men with luck, and the blacksmith rose suddenly, and other things Moiraine could not make out. Suddenly she stopped dead and said,
"She never went near Raheen, Moiraine. The Black Aja knows the dragon was reborn, but they don't bloody know when. Maybe Tamra managed to keep it back, or maybe they were too rough and she died before they could pry it out of her. That has to be it."
Her eagerness turned to horror.
"Light. They're killing any man or boy who might be able to channel. Oh, burn me. Thousands could die, Moiraine. Tens of thousands.
It did make a terrible sense. Men who could channel seldom knew what they were doing, at least in the beginning. At first, they often just seemed to be lucky. Events favored them, and frequently, like the blacksmith, they rose to prominence with unexpected suddenness. Swan was right. The Black Aja had begun a slaughter. "But they do not know to look for a baby," Moiraine said, as hard as she had to be. "An infant will show no signs. We have more time than we thought. Not enough to be careless, though. Any sister can be black. I think Cadswain is. They know others are looking. If one of Tamra's searchers locates the boy and they find her with him, or if they decide to question one of them instead of killing her as soon as it is convenient..." Swan was staring at her. "We still have the task," Moiraine told her. "I know," Swan said slowly. "I just never thought... Well, when there's work to do, you haul nets or gut fish." That lacked her usual force, though. "We can be on our way to Arafel before noon." "You go back to the tower," Moiraine said. Together they could search no faster than one could alone, and if they had to be apart, what better place for Swan than working for Satalia Dalarm, seeing the reports of all the Blue Aja eyes and ears? While Moiraine hunted for the boy, Swan could learn what was happening in every land, and knowing what she was looking for, she could spot any sign of the Black Aja or the Dragon Reborn. Swan truly could see sense when it was pointed out to her, though it took some effort this time, and when she agreed, she did it with a poor grace. "Satalia will use me to caulk drafts for running off without leave," she grumbled. "Burn me, hung out on a drying rack in the tower. I'll be lucky if she doesn't have me birched. Moiraine, the politics are enough to make you sweat buckets in midwinter. I hate it." But she was already pawing through the trunks to see what she could take with her for the ride back to Tarvalen. "I suppose you warned that fellow Lan. Seems to me he deserves it, much good it'll do him. I heard he rode out an hour ago, heading for the Blight, and if that doesn't kill him, where are you going?" "I have unfinished business with the man," Moiraine said over her shoulder. She had made a decision about him the first day she knew him, if he turned out not to be a dark friend, and she intended to keep it. In the stable where Arrow was kept, silver marks tossed like pennies got the mare saddled and bridled almost while the coins were still in air, and she scrambled onto the animal's back without a care that her skirts pushed up to bare her legs above the knee. Digging her heels in, she galloped out of the Aes Daishar and north through the city, making people leap aside, and once setting Arrow to leap cleanly over an empty wagon, with a driver too slow to move out of her way. She left a tumult of shouts and shaken fists behind. On the road north from the city, she slowed enough to ask wagon drivers heading the other way whether they had seen a Malkyrie on a bay stallion, and was more than a little relieved the first time she got a yes. The man could have gone in 50 directions after crossing the moat bridge, and with an hour's lead. She would catch him if she had to follow him into the Blight. "A Malkyrie?" The skinny merchant in a dark blue cloak looked startled. "Well, my guards told me there's one up there. Dangerous fellows, those Malkyrie." Twisting on his wagon seat, he pointed to a grassy hill 100 paces off the road. Two horses stood in plain sight at the crest, one a pack horse, and the thin smoke of a fire curled into the breeze. Lan barely looked up when she dismounted. Kneeling beside the remains of a small fire, he was stirring the ashes with a long twig. Strangely, the smell of burned hair hung in the air.
"I had hoped you were done with me," he said.
"Not quite yet," she told him. "Burning your future? It will sorrow a great many, I think, when you die in the Blight."
"Burning my past," he said, rising. "Burning memories, a nation. The Golden Crane will fly no more."
He started to kick dirt over the ashes, then hesitated and bent to scoop up damp soil and pour it out of his hands almost formally.
"No one will sorrow for me when I die, because those who would are dead already. Besides, all men die."
"Only fools choose to die before they must. I want you to be my warder, Lan Mandragoran." He stared at her unblinking, then shook his head.
I should have known it would be that. I have a war to fight, Aes Sedai, and no desire to help you weave White Tower webs, find another.
I fight the same war as you, against the Shadow. Marian was Black Aja. She told him all of it, from Gitara's foretelling in the presence of the Armalyn seat and two accepted, to what she and Swan had reasoned out, the deaths of Tamra's searchers, every last bit. For another man, she would have left most unsaid, but there were few secrets between Warder and Aes Sedai. For another man, she might have softened it, but she did not believe hidden enemies frightened him, not even when they were Aes Sedai. You said you burned your past. Let the past have its ashes. This is the same war, Lan, the most important battle yet in that war, and this one you can win. For a long time he stood staring north toward the Blight. She did not know what she would do if he refused. She had told him more than she should have anyone but her bonded warder. Suddenly he turned, sword flashing out, and for an instant she thought he meant to attack her. Instead he sank to his knees, the sword lying bare across his hands.
By my mother's name, I will draw as you say draw, and sheathe as you say sheathe. By my mother's name, I will come as you say come, and go as you say go.
He kissed the blade and looked up at her expectantly. On his knees, he made any king on a throne look meek. She would have to teach him some humility for his own sake, and for a pawn's sake. There is a little more, she said, laying hands on his head. The weave of spirit was one of the most intricate known to Aes Sedai. It wove around him, settled into him, vanished. Suddenly she was aware of him, in the way that Aes Sedai were of their warders. His emotions were a small knot in the back of her head, all steely hard determination, sharp as his blade's edge. She knew the muted pain of old injuries, tamped down and ignored. She would be able to draw on his strength at need, to find him however far away he was. They were bonded. He rose smoothly, sheathing his sword, studying her.
Men who weren't there call it the Battle of the Shining Walls, he said abruptly. Men who were call it the Blood Snow. No more. They know it was a battle. On the morning of the first day, I led nearly 500 men, Kandori, Saldaeans, Damani. By evening on the third day, half were dead or wounded. Had I made different choices, some of those dead would be alive, and others would be dead in their places. In war, you say a prayer for your dead and ride on, because there is always another fight over the next horizon. Say a prayer for the dead, Moiraine Sedai, and ride on.
Startled, she came close to gaping. She had forgotten that the bond's flow worked both ways. He knew her emotions, too, and apparently could make out hers far better than she could his. After a moment, she nodded, though she did not know how many prayers it would take to clear her mind. Handing her arrow's reins, he said,
"Where do we ride first?"
"Back to Chachin," she admitted. "And then Arafel and..." So few names remained that were easy to find. "The world, if need be. We win this battle, or the world dies." Side by side, they rode down the hill and turned south. Behind them, the sky rumbled and turned black, another late storm rolling down from the Blight.
I began writing The Wheel of Time because a great many notions had been bouncing around inside my head and they started to coalesce. I wondered what it was really like to be tapped on the shoulder and told, "You were born to be the savior of mankind." I didn't think it would be very much the way it is in so many books where someone pops up and says, "Hi, I was born to be the savior of mankind, and here's the prophecy," and everybody says, "Oh, well, let's go then." I thought self-interest would play a big part on other people's parts. And I was also wondering about the source of legends and myths. They can't all be anthropomorphizations of natural events. Some of them have to be distortions of things that actually happened, distortions by being passed down over generations. And that led into the distortion of information, the inevitable distortion of information over distance, whether that's temporal distance or spatial distance. The further you are in time or space from the actual event, the less likely you are to know what really happened. And then finally, there was the thought about something that happens in Tolkien and a lot of other places, the wise old wizard or whatever, the wise old fellow shows up in a small country village and says, "You must follow me to save the world." And the villagers say, "Right then, Gov, off we go." And, well, I did a lot of growing up in the country, and I always thought that what those country folk would say, "Oh, is that so? Look here, have another beer. Have two on me. I'll be right back. I will, really." And then slip out the back door. There were a lot of things that came together, and even once I started, of course, a lot of things built in and added in and changed. Oh, my books are fantasy, certainly. And so I like the term. Of course, there are a lot of people who write fantasy who don't like the term. The magic realists don't like the term. And, you know, Doris Lessing, that's fantasy. And A.S. Byatt, that's fantasy. But there are a lot of people who write, as I say, they write fantasy, and they're not going to allow fantasy on the to be put on the cover of their book, because they think they're being consigned to the ghetto if that happens. Well, okay, I wear my ghetto tattoos proudly. I wrote New Spring to be accessible to someone who has read none of the books. That is, somebody who's read the books is going to find a few things explained in New Spring, such as what the One Power is, that things that they've already had explained, things that they know. But I simply decided to go along with the way that I had done it in the novella. This is to be accessible to someone who's never read a book in the Wheel of Time.
We hope you've enjoyed New Spring by Robert Jordan, an audio renaissance audiobook from Tor Forge. Text copyright 2004 by Robert Jordan. Production copyright 2004, Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtz Brink Publishers, LLC, and Books on Tape, Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.